Welcome back, everybody, to the Be Better podcast. This time around, you only have me. Coach Gabby's on vacation. She's actually off training in some secret location so that she can be super good again this year, and who knows what's going to come about that. But in her place, we have a guest. We have him on the phone here. He's a good friend of mine and actually is one of my mentors in the coaching world. I'd like to introduce you guys to my friend, Bobby McGee. Bobby, welcome, and thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Chris. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, so we are calling you on the phone today, and where are you right now?
I'm based in Lafayette in Colorado, which is about 5 miles east of Boulder.
Nice. And you live in Boulder now, is that correct?
Correct. I live in Lafayette, so I live just sort of in Boulder County.
Gotcha. Now, so you're just like a stone's throw from all the burritos and triathletes then, not too far away.
Actually, I'm right in the heart of it because, you know, this is starting to get, just a little bit away from the foothills. A lot of the athletes are starting to think this might be a better option for them. You know, there's a lot more flat country to ride in, that kind of thing. And then also, just being out of the epicenter of Boulder. Boulder's grown so phenomenally in the 20-plus years that I've been here that it's become extremely congested. And so a lot of the athletes are staying on the periphery and moving a little bit out of Boulder so that they just quicker into the training rides and a little less pressure on the pools and you know, similar trails, accessibility, that kind of thing. It's a burgeoning community in that way. It's sort of spreading a little bit more.
Well, I think you could probably join the Chamber of Commerce with a speech like that. You just totally made me want to move there now.
Well, with climate change, the weather, you know, we very dry, ski industry is struggling, you know, so we've got some droughts going on, and I'm sure that we don't get some snow in, you know, early parts of spring and summer. I hope we don't have the California situation with fires, which we can sometimes get.
Oh, that was, I know that's the fires in that area, especially stretching all the way down to the Springs. I mean, I've seen the devastation there, and they've been kind of scary. I've had a couple guys from the USAT offices send me photos from the offices looking at some of those fires as they're coming closer, and that's scary. It's truly is horrific.
Absolutely. And I was in Santa Monica actually during the last of the big fires that they had in California, and being in the hotel and seeing all the people, you know, checking into the hotel that have been evacuated, it really struck close to home.
Well, we'll put a big wish out that everybody's safe, and wish for snow and some moisture coming to your way, because we'd hate to have
Absolutely.
Anything happen.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, well, hey, it's the least I could do. Just honestly, the least I could do is just hope. About your military background, I'm not sure many people knew that you were in the military back in South Africa, but would you share a little bit about, you know, what your background was?
Yeah, funnily enough, my friends in triathlon that have military backgrounds have chatted to me about that in the past, yes. But I was conscripted into the South African Defense Force when I was in high school, actually in 11th grade. And in those days, it would be for 9 months of service. But my father felt, look, if I went into the military at that stage of the game, I wouldn't go to college. You know, I'd lose my way. So he said, go to college first, which was an option. But by the time I graduated, it was a 4-year process. So 2 years full time and then another 2 years worth of camps. So it would be 3 months worth of camps every year until you'd worked off 2 years. And it was only the white South African population that was conscripted. So, you know, it was pretty much 100%. We had some conscientious objectors, which went to the 180 days without trial continuously for a 2-year process. And, you know, as a young man, too, you know, getting an opportunity to go and serve, not all a bad thing. It was an interesting conflict of which I don't think a lot of people really understood how it worked. But it was around about the time, I think it started in 66 or 65, somewhere in there. But it was around about the time where, you know, East Germany and Russia were making a big push into Africa. And just like it was in the U.S., it was that fear of, you know, socialism or communism coming down the red danger, as they called it. And so we went up to Southwest Africa, which is nowadays called Namibia, was a buffer zone for South Africa. And so we served in along the border with between Namibia and Angola. So either in northern Namibia or in Angola itself. And so I was conscripted as an infantryman, and did my basic training, and then went to officers training school and became a lieutenant. And so I saw some action in northern Namibia, and then and then eventually with all the camps and everything, I ended up being an infantry captain by the time it was all said and done. And then 92. Apartheid ended, and that whole conscription mechanism came to an end, and now it's it's a voluntary defense force in South Africa, and sort of that's the sum total of it. Little bit of detail: I was a light machine gunner, so I served in an infantry platoon, and I carried a light machine gun, so I was one of three or four, depending on the size of our platoon. At the end, old British style firing movement kind of thing. So I was a firing movement support gunner, you know, with nice. my Ren number two, who's still a very good friend of mine.
So I was going to say, that was my question. Do you still have any contact with any of the people you served with, or are they all gone, or?
No, you know, those people who serve know that people that you serve with, individuals that you serve with are friends for life, forever, you know. So there are two of my buddies, my oldest buddies, and they were both buddies that we were in the military with. Yeah, so that would be, you know, my number two on the LMG, plus another fellow who served in a different platoon to me, but we were in the same company.
Well, that's,
so, yep. Wow, friends for life.
That's great. And, you know, so I, like I said, so that was a big piece that I didn't know about you. And I think that adds a lot of color to your background. The other thing that I was really intrigued to understand, and you told me this, and I think the shock was on my face for a while. Bobby's not your God-given name, is it?
No. Interesting little story there. I went to see an applied kinesiologist in Cape Town many years ago, and when he was standing at the reception, he took my name and he said, "Nope, Bobby's not your name." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He said, "No, it just doesn't resonate with who you are," which was kind of, you know, freaky and out there. But either way, my real name is Malcolm, and I was at university in university in 1975, and Janis Joplin and me and Bobby McGee and Chris Christopherson's version and Gordon Lightfoot's version was very popular at the time. And my college professor gave me the nickname straight away, and he called me Bobby. And then by the time I got to my third year, he was calling me Robert, having forgotten that he gave me the nickname.
That might be my favorite part of that whole story, is that he forgot that he gave you the nickname and he thought your real name was Bobby.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's super cool. So you were a high school teacher at one point in time, and that's kind of how you got into coaching, is that right?
Correct. So, you know, when I finished high school, my father said, "Well, what's your best subject? What do you want to go and study?" And I said, "Look, my best subject is sport." And he said, "Well, what do you want to be a pro athlete in?" I said, "Nah, I'm never going to be good enough to be a pro athlete, but I'd like to be a coach." So from day one, I wanted to do that. But with apartheid, there weren't those kind of options to be able to, you know, make a living out of coaching. You know, we had rugby and we had cricket, and it was at a very high level. But it, you know, the highest level you got to is you would make these pseudo national teams, so that if you did go to the Olympics or if you did go to the World Championships or if you did go to, you know, world competitions, you would be in that team, but you wouldn't get to go to those competitions. So there were many years where I was involved in sport where you know, people aspire to make the national team. And so I aspired to coach national team runners. But even as a high school coach, I said I'd love to coach an Olympic medalist. You know, and obviously that was very far away from reality in the early 80s and the late 70s. But so I went and studied phys ed, and with the sole purpose of being a coach. And I knew the only way that I could really get into coaching was being a high school teacher, because I'd get a coaching job. So the first school that I got to, 1981, there was already a very respected track and field coach there. And so I didn't get the job to be the cross country or the track coach. I got a job to be C and D team hockey, field hockey coach. So that's where I started coaching. I was a field hockey coach. But I was actually a better field hockey player myself than I was a runner. As, you know, I ran college, I ran cross country, but I didn't make the collegiate A team. In fact, the running density was so high there that in teams of six, I think I was in the D or maybe the E team, you know.
Wow, and, that's deep. But, I didn't even know they went down to that many letters.
Oh, yeah. They went really, really deep. If you think about it, you know, the guys that were now A team were 334, 335, 50 nanometer runners.
Wow.
So, you know, we had incredible depth as a running school. And we had 19 rugby teams as well at university, you know, so
19?
All the way down. So 19, yeah.
Oh my God.
And that didn't count the resident teams, you know. So sport was everything. I, you know, even as a field hockey player, I played in what you would probably consider the minors here. I played South African country districts, which is below, you know, provincial level.
Okay.
And even then, we used to practice 5 hours a day on top of a full study schedule, you know. So
sport was a
big thing in those days. But, you know, the culmination was, for example, was something called the Super Sport Competition, where all the top cricketers in the country and the top track and field guys and top rugby players and all the sports, women's netball, things like that, they all got together and had a competition to see who the greatest athlete in the country was. So, and it was funny, it was often won by the gymnast. The gymnasts seem to, you know, they're fast, they're agile, they're athletic, they have great talent. So with all these different skills that they were given, they often came out on top. And of course,
what was that competition
the
like?
Like,
what do they do
they would, you know, you'd have gymnasts and cricketers and everybody, they would run a 200 and they would see how many sit-ups they could do in 100, in 60 seconds. And they'd do pull-ups and they'd play little bits of other people's sports. So they would ride a racing bike around the track for 400 meters, you know, a crit bike, you know. And, you know, so they do little bits of everybody's sport, plus just some invented things, you know, sort of depth jumping and monkey bars and balancing activities and so on. So they, you know, multiple little competitions that culminated in a final winner.
Cool. That is super cool. I never heard of that. And you said the gymnasts were usually the best of them all?
Yeah, the gymnasts did really well. They got very high levels of muscle endurance. They're very fast. Their power-to-weight ratio is very good. You know, so hand-eye stuff, obviously the field hockey players, the cricketers did really, really well there. But, you know, overall as athletes, the gymnasts seemed to dominate. And it might also be in the nature of the competition, but it was interesting. You know, perennially the worst competitors of all of them were the cyclists. All they could do was ride a bike. They couldn't catch. They couldn't throw. They couldn't jump. They couldn't sprint. They couldn't run far. They could just ride their bike.
Well, there's no upper body on those guys. If you look at the like cyclists of today, I'm assuming that it was kind of the same as I wouldn't imagine they could do even one pull-up.
No, they were not. They were not good in any of those. Like, I think that sometimes the windsurfers did quite well because they had these very high levels of muscle endurance, you know, so they could do a lot of pull-ups and they could do a lot of push-ups and they could, and they were very good with balance and quickness and, you know, body position and so on, plyometrics. So it was a very eye-opening competition for me. I remember it was perennially sponsored by a high vitamin C candy that they had called Super C. Mm-hmm. So it was always called the Super C, you know, competition, which was very interesting.
And so give me like what year would this have been going on that you were doing these?
Pretty much the whole time that I was there, because remember when apartheid ended, then I was allowed to be involved in international sports. So we all then started to travel, those of us that were in any kind of top echelon in sport at that point in time. So that probably went on right throughout the 80s, okay. At least through the 80s, yeah.
And so when apartheid did go away and you did kind of get that window open to you, what were some of the first things that you did to kind of in breaking through?
It was an unbelievably interesting time. Very good friend of mine, Johnny Halberstadt, who's probably about 10 years older than me. He was, he was a world-class athlete. He's one of the few guys in the world that's run sub 29 for 10K, and he's run sub 4 for the mile, and he's run sub 13:30 for 5K. And he said the experience that he had as an athlete fighting for a representation for the black runners who were the best runners in South Africa always, and missing out on the Olympics as a result of apartheid, but being a standard bearer for equal rights and the ending of apartheid in South Africa, he feels that was a greater privilege for him. And I sometimes feel the same way, because although, there were times where we all got really bad press for being, coaches and so on, and being white folks in South Africa, but it was a fantastic time. The whole world came there. I was involved with a series of events called the Unity Games, which we had to show the world that we were fully integrated in sport, and obviously sport was way ahead of politics at that time. So we were setting up these meetings. We were going to schools, in the segregated areas. All the areas were segregated, but we were going to schools where all of the students were people of color, and, offering clinics and so on. And I remember my first Unity meeting, going in there and being introduced to a guy whose wife in the end turned out to be one of the best Comrades marathon runners that South Africa ever had. And her name was Fatawa Mentua. Anyway, I met her husband, and her husband came over to me, and he was a coach as well, introduced himself to me and said, this is my name, and I'm a member of Inkonto Wesizwe, which was basically in the old apartheid regime of South Africa, the Nationalist Party regime. Was the military wing of the ANC, and at that time considered as a terrorist organization. So I had this weird moment where I was talking to a soldier from the other side, as it were, and we were at an athletics coaching meeting, and it was a really, really funky time. So, there were times where we were in danger. I coached two individuals that belonged to an organization called SACOS, which their leading epithet for the organization was No Normal Sport in an Abnormal Society. So, their sport organization existed almost exclusively to fight apartheid.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, so their best two athletes were so far and above anybody else within this really small little organization of theirs in the Western Cape, that they approached me to coach them. And the epithet was, listen, we'd love you to coach us, but nobody may know that you coach us, because they had to participate, against only people of color. They weren't allowed to participate against white folks, which were, because of opportunities and advantages and so on, were, a far superior athlete body. So there were times that I was down at the stadium with these athletes racing with a big old army surplus trench coat on with a collar turned up and a hoodie on, and so that nobody would see I was a white person, and I was standing outside the fence watching my athletes compete.
Oh,
so that
wow.
I could get some, I could actually watch them race, And, I could have got beaten up, but I don't think there was, any real danger there, but there were fun times there, and so it did eventually get to a point where it was very, very dangerous to be coaching across those lines. It was a very interesting time.
It's interesting to think of it that way, because I would never have thought that coaching would be something that'd be dangerous. In my background, I was a police officer for 12 years here in Minneapolis, and I went to coaching because I wanted to do something that wasn't dangerous anymore. And I always think of how tame it is now. But to hear you talk about, you know, obviously being in a different time, in a different culture, a different country, there's so many different ramifications and different levels there. But it's interesting to think about there being risk like that, and that's kind of, I guess you have to be committed to the art and the craft of coaching to be willing to kind of be put into that scenario or into that space.
Yeah, you know, but the flip side of that is 1% difficult for me as a white person in South Africa at that time.
Yeah.
99% too near impossible for a person of color to succeed. Because you remember we had apartheid for all those years. The sports embargo, especially in my event, which was, you know, distance running, the sports embargo that the rest of the world was applying to South Africa detrimented those runners the most. So in other words, the black athletes were the ones that, you know, it should have been a racially motivated embargo. You know, we will let people of color from your country participate, but white people can't.
Oh,
and
wow.
It wasn't that. It was just this blanket thing. So, you know, if you looked at the 15 best 10-mile runners in South Africa at that time, probably 14 of them were black guys.
Yeah.
You know, and so these 14 lost the opportunity to make a living on the roads of the world, you know. It was completely messed up. It was a disaster. But during that transition phase, it was an unbelievably exciting time to be involved and to be fighting, for equal opportunities for these athletes. So one of those two athletes eventually set the South African record for 1500 meters and became the sixth best miler 1500 meter runner in the world that one of those years, and that record stood for 21 years before it was broken.
Wow, that's awesome. What was their name?
Say again, what was his name?
Yeah, what was his name?
Yeah, his name was Johan Landsman, Landsman. He ran 333 for 1500 meters, and that record was only broken very recently, maybe the last 3-4 years.
Wow. That's crazy. That's amazing. Now, how long was it before you were introduced to Josiah? Because Josiah was kind of your introduction into the Olympic running game. Is that correct?
Yeah. So in 1992, we were reallowed back into the Olympic movement for the first games we had since, I think the last games we were in the games was 64. I think so. So which is what was 64 was Rome, I think. Yeah.
Yep.
And that was the last games that we were allowed in. And so 92, we were reallowed into the Olympic Games. And in that games, a number of really interesting things happened. So the three sports, which was track and field, road running, and cross country, which were three different bodies at that time. The one that was the most successful was the road running one, because that was run like a corporation. It was being run really well. It was this complete and utter realization that the heroes were the athletes, that they were the runners.
Yep.
It didn't come from a amateur-based society that we grew up in. You know, it was absolutely born in the professional age. And we had the situation where all of the gold mines, coal mines in South Africa had sports clubs. And the way that you could get yourself out from underground as a black runner was to run really well and be on the mines team. And if you were on the mines team, you'd get some menial job on the surface. You wouldn't have to be a miner. So you'd get out from underground and you could run.
Okay.
And as vile as that may sound, it was an unbelievable talent identification, motivational environment, because these guys came from far and wide because they needed a job, but they could run for a living, you know, and that produced the likes of Josiah and David Sebe, world number one marathon runner, you know, and Berlin Marathon winner, David Sebe, Kole Yawa, just endless names, winners of the Peachtree Road Race, Simon Morrillong, you just can't name it. Even Matthews Machuaratoa, who was the first guy to break 28 minutes on the road for 10K. Anyway, these guys, that's how I met Josiah, because I was working with the middle distance runners. And I think it's important in a conversation like this to draw the distinction between, in those days, what was called the colored person, which was a person from mostly the Western Cape, and they sort of made indigenous people, that, from the Malay slaves and the Dutch settlers. And that was the community that I lived in, and I primarily worked with those athletes. And when those athletes started becoming successful, I started getting involved as a coach with sports agents. Because some of the big agencies in the world were now interested in South African athletes because they were allowed back into the international fold. And so I became involved with a sports agency there, and one of their clients, they had this agent that I worked with had 55 athletes. Some of them were track athletes, but most of them were road running athletes. And that's how I got to meet Josiah, because he was one of those. And I had a little business called Performax back in South Africa, where I would help these athletes prepare in South Africa and then accompany them over to the London Marathon or the Berlin Marathon or the New York Marathon or the Chicago Marathon. They'd race there. And so I'd take care of them when they were back in South Africa and then bring them over to the races, because in those days it was very hard to get visas and so on for Africans to travel to the U.S. and to Europe.
Gotcha.
And, Josiah, the first time Josiah ran New York, I got a visa for the U.S. for 6 months. I only had to be out of the country for a week, and then I'd get a visa again for 6 months. And that visa would last for 10 years. The visa that we could get for Josiah was 6 days.
Six days?
I was only allowed to race in the New York Marathon, get back, and he was still held in customs for over 2 hours the time he went over. We learned very quickly what the realities were, of prejudice throughout the world,
Where you started to see yourself as like almost a coach advocate for that, where, you were in a unique position to be able to maybe step up and say things for your athletes? Did that ever come into play?
Oh, yeah. Especially with Barcelona. We realized we wanted to do heat and humidity training rather than altitude training. And so we brought the athletes that came from, the hinterland, South Africa's southern hemisphere. So it's winter, June, July, So we brought those guys down to coastal venues and not a lot of elite housing available for those athletes on the coast. And so we stayed in an all-white complex. And the night that we arrived there, the caretaker came out and said, "Sorry, you guys can't stay here." And I said, "Look, we paid for everything. And, it's all covered. And we know about this and this and the other." And it turned into a bit of a standoff,
Oh, wow.
And I tried to bring the whole thing to a low profile thing before the press showed up, because the guy, called the cops, et cetera, et cetera. But in the end, we defused the situation. I think the gentleman lost his job. And those people that had rented the apartments to us stepped in as well and said, "Wait a minute, this is a whole new ball game. What are you even thinking?" And so obviously, like you've heard so much with segregation and so on, there's still to this day, there are going to be those kind of pains about, where people live and where they feel welcome and where they don't. And one of those runners, who was the South African record holder at the time for the marathon, a 208 runner, was extremely fearful, and there was at no point were the athletes in danger, but just that whole culture of apartheid is, if this thing is escalating, I'm in danger, my life's in danger, So it took my wife, quite a bit of time to calm him down and say, "Look, this is a very uncomfortable situation, but it's not a bad situation." And in the end, it turned out that we actually had to move, just because the athletes just felt so unwelcome and so uncomfortable there that we went somewhere else.
Oh, That's hard. I mean, that's an interesting point about it because, you know, we've talked about the mental aspect of sport and how impactful it is. And if you do have that anxiety hanging over you, that is definitely something I'm sure you recognized immediately that was a huge detriment to their ability to compete at the highest level at that point in time.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. And, you know, the whole picture, the professionalization, the sports science, the nutrition concepts, I remember doing talent identification, and the biggest challenge I came up against in the beginning was all of these little talented runners that, you know, you do a little time trial with them on a little airstrip or something like that, and they'd be completely winded, and you go, what's going on? And, you know, then you take the better ones and you have them tested, and these guys have got no iron at all. Their iron stores are terrible. And, you know, come to find out, you know, that it's parasites. And, you know, so you have to end up helping these athletes get rid of these parasites so that they could absorb iron. And then obviously, nutrition, once you're behind the eight ball with iron, you know, it's quite a costly business to get those iron stores up. So, you know, they could have been all these brilliant athletes around, but you could never discover them because they weren't healthy enough for them to be able to even show what they were capable of.
I've heard, you know, similar stories about that, and it's interesting to hear from your perspective. In that, I don't think a lot of people get to hear that or get to see that firsthand. It kind of takes me aback to think about just being in that. I'm at a loss for words here.
Well, you know, I think Randy Wilbur was very good at pointing this out. As people always saying, you know, what makes the Kenyans great? What makes the Ethiopians great? What makes the Africans great? And, you know, I think, sure, there's altitude involved. Sure, there's power-to-weight ratio involved. There's tiny little skeletons. There's leg length versus torso length. Certain tribes built better to be runners than other tribes, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the bottom line is that factor that Frank Shorter speaks about, Bill Rogers speaks about, is that most of these athletes that succeed at this very high level in the sports that require suffering are athletes that have come through very, very, very tough times in their lives. You know, so we've had athletes that succeed at the very highest level and are not from altitude. And, you know, so it's that hardship growing up. It's that succeed at all costs, because there is, if you fail, then, you know, you're doomed to a life of poverty.
Yeah, it is. It's a mindset, I guess.
Absolutely. You know, just to hear an African runner talk about dealing with the discomfort of, you know, running 4:45 for 26 miles, they don't consider it as pain or discomfort. They consider it as just the cost of doing business. And that mindset alone right there, you know, says a lot.
Yeah,
and with the kids in the U.S. that succeed, I see the same thing. They have a different attitude towards how hard it is. They'll take the admiration and the newspaper guys and the journos saying, "Wow, you're just so tough. You know, you put up with this injury, or you put up with this heat, or you put up with this level of discomfort." But I have a completely different internal dialogue about what it takes to succeed.
And I see that there's this I've often referred to it as the entitlement problem, that, you know, you see it in young athletes, that they feel entitled to certain things. And whether it's, you know, they're triathletes coming up and hey, I'm good, so I'm entitled to sponsorship, or I should have this, or I shouldn't have to put up with this, or you just have to, you know, you can almost see it at the youth and junior level, who's going to, you know, succeed and who's not, just kind of by who has the attitude of gratefulness, or who is kind of the whiny snot in the background. Because somebody can be physically gifted, but you definitely need that internal drive to be great. And, you know, that's why I think if you think about a lot of the people who have been the best of the best, they do have background stories where they've overcome something, or they come from poverty. Nobody, you know, is coming from, you know, a huge place of privilege or wealth. And you do need that at some point in time. And, do you think that by taking people out of that atmosphere, that it's that we risk kind of washing that work ethic away? Or do you think that once it's instilled into you, that it always remains?
You know, I probably wouldn't be able to give a definitive answer on that, but I did know with the South African runners in those early days, those guys would come over to Europe or to the US and they would win a race or two, or they'd win a big city marathon, and they would earn more money than they could possibly earn in 10 years of labor, you know?
Yep.
And so they would go home and say, look, I'm set. I don't have to go out and do that again. I've got what I need. You know, there's that old saying, you can take the man out of Africa, but you can't take Africa out of the man.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, myself and Mark Platches, we both feel the same way. There's just something about, you know, being South Africans that you just, I just can't move away from it. And so these guys would go home and they would, you know, buy themselves, you know, a little hotel or, you know, some sort of investment or some sort of business. And then they would quit. They would just, you know, they've made enough.
They don't need it.
So, you know, it comes at back five, you know, so it's not like the, you know, like the great golfers. I mean, there's so many golfers out there that are top 50 in the world, and they don't really aspire to being number one because it's just too much hard work to being that, you know, that visual to the public and being a hero and so on. So, you know, I'm making 15 or 25 million a year, and I don't need the headache that comes with making 50 a year, you know? Some of the runners just, you know, they, runners are, you know, African runners are often very introvert, and they're very quiet individuals, and they're willing to put up with delayed gratification and so on. So they don't necessarily need the limelight. And it was difficult for some of the American agents and some of the you know, the elite athlete coordinators in these big marathons will always say, you know, it's hard for us because the Africans don't want to go to the prize giving. They walk away afterwards. And, you know, you had those difficult years in the U.S. where they had U.S. only money, and, you know, they wouldn't give money to foreigners that come to the races because they would be so much better, you know, so the U.S. kids wouldn't make sufficient money. But then, you know, that's all changed now because the U.S. is a phenomenal distance running country, and the kids definitely hold their own today, which is a beautiful thing to see, you know.
It is. It's interesting. I mean, even with some of the people in our sport of triathlon, because you came to triathlon about 2002, right? Would you say that's about
correct?
Yeah. And you came into that with when you started Bobby McGee Endurance Sports, and did you see triathlon originally as just another place to kind of try and that was like almost like a target rich market, or did you see that there was the availability for people to develop, or was there more raw talent there? What kind of drew you into triathlon away from the, you know, just kind of pure running?
Oh, very simple story, actually. I'll tell you what drew me into triathlon in the U.S. and what drew me to triathlon is in 84 or 85. I mean, I was as big a fan as anybody. You know, I had all the
newspaper clippings.
Yeah, that's when I started with triathlon. I said, look, I want to do an Ironman. I want to do triathlon. And one of the driving forces was I'm never going to be a good enough runner. And triathlon is a little bit one of those sports in those days where if you had some guts and a little bit of aerobic talent and you stuck around long enough, you'd eventually find a way to get, you know, close to the top of the podium. And, you know, in the end, I did. I think I got fifth in one race, and I got eighth in another race, and I was sort of, you know, in national class races. Most of them where the swim was ridiculously short, or the tide was out, and I could walk most of the swim. but that's and one of the driving forces was, you know what? I want something for me. You know, in running, I just at the end of the day of coaching a whole day, I was going, the last thing I want to do is go out and run and keep up with my efforts to try and break, you know, 34 or 35 for 10K, or to try and break 36 off the bike, you know, was far more exciting to me. So I said, okay, triathlon is my thing. You know, I'm not, when people say, look, will you help me train as a triathlete? I say, no, I'm not interested in that, because it's my sport. It's what I do. I coach runners, you know.
This is Bobby time.
Then in 2000, Then in 2002, was it 2000? Yeah, I think 2002. Basically, Libby Burrell was the high performance director of triathlon, you know, of USAT. And Bob had that mishap in Houston, I think it was, where she collapsed just before the finishing line and didn't make that Olympic team. And she was, you know, really a world-class swimmer, and she was fantastic on the bike. And Libby really thought she would be a good candidate for Athens. And she needed to figure out a way to run. And so Libby approached me and said, you know, would I be interested in working on Bob's run? And I agreed to that. And, you know, that was my moment. Started with USA Triathlon, basically helping Bob out. And then I just started doing coach education. And, you know, so I was a service provider for USA Triathlon from 2002. I'd worked the elite camps and way back then, yeah.
And you've seen some big dogs come through. I know that you're working with Gwen, I think you said.
Yep.
Which is an interesting transformation there as well, her story.
Yeah, it's funny, you know. I was just telling Gwen this yesterday that you know, Bob came from the swimming background. She swam at Stanford. She was so heavily invested in the swimming world, and then, you know, basically had her heart broken that she, you know, she didn't make it into the Olympic team, you know, for numerous reasons, and then had this restart as a triathlete. And then when we got her going well on the run, you know, the time consumed by the bike, and, you know, when she'd finished and she went and did Ironman, I think 2009 or late 2008. Well, no, late 2004, I think, or early 2000. I can't remember if she did it in 2004 or 2005, but she did that. And then she, you know, she started the CRP, and she said, you know what, the funnest thing for me is to just go for a run. I don't take my bike anywhere. You know, I'll swim if I'm helping people in the water, but, you know, basically my thing is my run, you know?
Yeah.
And she's now finally come around back to the swimming. Now she's enjoying her swimming again. But, you know, Gwen was the same. You know, she started off as a swimmer and then became a runner at college and then, you know, became a triathlete. But she always loved to run. You know, she just is something compact, economical. I would be interesting to see a research done on what the level of endorphin production is when you're comparing swimming to biking to running. And I've got a sneaking suspicion that the whole anti-inflammatory buzz, the whole high that you get, is much easier to access when you're running than it is when you're swimming or biking. I might be wrong, but it just seems that these athletes, they you know, running is just so...
Well, they call it a runner's high.
You know, so you don't hear primal, you know?
You don't hear anybody saying, I have a swimmer's high. No, people complain about swimming because it's cold and it makes you stink like chlorine. But it's a passion, right? But and biking is a whole other, I think, has its own subculture in biking that running, you know, doesn't necessarily. Running, I guess, does have, like, endurance running. They have their own subculture. It's there is that, but not as much as biking. But I have never heard anybody say that, you know, I get a biking high. I don't think I've ever gotten a biking high. I do enjoy it. I enjoy a lot of the things that come from bicycling, and riding my bike. But running is definitely a whole different mechanism. You know, there's nothing else involved with it. It's, you just need a pair of, you know, pair of tennis shoes and some shorts and a shirt, optional, if you're a guy. You know, the other things, you need something. You don't really need anything as a runner, and it's more available. And maybe it's because running is something you do almost immediately as a child that it has that associated with it. I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's very primal. I mean, I think running is more primal because of fight or flight than walking is, you know?
Yep.
So it's probably the first activity, the first human activity, you know, from that perspective. You know, you run into war, you run away from the enemy, but you walk around gracious, you know, comfortably while you're picking berries, but you don't turn your back and walk casually away from a saber-toothed tiger or walk casually towards a woolly mammoth with your stone-tipped spear, right?
Yeah.
So it's right. It's very, very primal. And that's probably what makes it so difficult to teach skills and so on in that regard. But I do think that, you know, running has that to it, you know. And I was never able to run really great distances. You know, I ran my fair share of marathons and so on. But just, you know, just how I was built was not, you know, suited to being a great runner, but I was drawn to it from the beginning. I remember I used to race pedal cars when I was at university, you know, those 24-hour pedal car races, the inter-university races.
Yep.
And I was part of a team backed by the engineering department, so we had this aluminum frame car and so on. But you had to do just a straight up a whole lot of biking. So I joined up with a local cycling crew in Stellenbosch where I was at university, and one of them was a multiple world record holder for, you know, 24 hours on a bike, or, you know, for a recumbent. He held a 1 hour record for distance achieved on a recumbent and so on. And he was a national class rider. And if it wasn't apartheid, he definitely would have been an international rider. He was definitely a sort of Tour de France caliber type rider, you know.
Okay.
But I remember riding with him one day, and we were climbing up a little mountain pass, and he said, you know, you're wasting your time with running. You're so much better on a bike than you are as a runner. And I said, you know what? You're probably right. But as cyclists, you guys are such scumbags that I just don't want to be associated with this community. Because, you know, the guys were, you know blue collar and hard bitten, and anything goes. You know, you stick stuff in each other's spokes and you knock each other off the road and
so on.
It's
dirty. It's dirty behind the scenes of cycling.
Exactly. And I was just too much of a purist and too naive. And I thought, you know, and I had raced against some of these guys and, you know, saw how they operate. And I thought, yeah, no, I don't think so.
Hard pass. Going to do a hard pass.
Yeah.
Well, that's.
But I don't know if. I still don't think I would have been anywhere near national class as a cyclist either. So, yeah.
Well, I think you turned out fairly well in my eyes. I think that you found a good route. You know, to kind of give our listeners one little tidbit. If you've been watching people of all different forms and sizes and calibers run for so long. If there's one commonality that you see that people have that they do wrong running, we'll tool this down to say an age grouper American, and it could be either a triathlete or a pure runner. What is one of the main or one of the most common things that you talk to people about fixing? In general, what's the thing you go, you know, I'm going to see this. This is what people always have wrong, and I know I'm going to tell somebody this.
Yeah, I would very much draw a distinction though between the average age group triathlete versus the average amateur runner.
Okay.
I think you see. I would probably give a different piece of advice to the average amateur runner that I would give to the average. Amateur triathlete, you know, age group triathlete.
Let's say it's triathlete. Since we are both in the sport of triathlon, and that might be who's listening.
Yep.
Let's go with triathlete. What would be that commonality that you see?
Then I'd have to draw another distinction again between
you're killing me here.
short course triathlete and long course triathlete.
All right, let's go long course triathletes.
Okay, long course triathletes. And I'm happy to share the others as well. So with a long course triathlete, there's this misconception in my mind that they need to run more to achieve the kind of run in a long course race that their run training makes them believe they are capable of. So they go run a 5K, a local 5K, or even run a local half marathon. They do the math. They figure out, well, I should be able to run this. And let's say I give up X amount of time off the bike. That means I should be able to run this. And they never come close, never, ever come close. And so I would say the biggest advice that I could give, or a tidbit that I could give, and it's not a mechanical tidbit, to a long course triathlete is that they need to ride more. They need to be sufficiently conditioned on the bike to allow the run that they are capable of.
So in order to be a faster runner, you need to ride more bike.
Exactly. Huh. They need to be better conditioned on the bike. That will allow the running that they have available, the runner that they are capable of being, to come to the fore. That would be my primary piece of advice.
Gotcha.
And then my second one is unless you're going a nice, solid 3 hours off the bike in Ironman, you have no business trying to run the whole way, because you're just adding 30 to 40 minutes to your marathon time. Run, walk, damn it. Don't. That's the extent of my cuss word on this podcast.
All right. Well, I think we can say that's not a cuss word. So would you say that walking the aid stations, if you're not going to run under 3 hours, is actually a valid piece of advice for long-distance Ironman?
Yes, but also patterning the run, pacing the run. So in other words, aid stations are quite frequent in an Ironman. And so I think that that's a really, really a great way to go. I would even go so far as to say you're breaking up the aid station walk, where you're going, the first part of the walk, maybe 20, 30 seconds is to catch my breath and to recover. The second part of that walk is to, hydrate or fuel. And then the third part of my little walk break is all about preparing myself for the next section that I'm going to run.
Yeah.
So break it up that way. So in other words, don't just say, I'm just going to completely take a walk break. Because, the complaint is for somebody that has some aspiration in Ironman is that if I do that, I lose my rhythm.
Yep.
And I think that the technical mistake they make is they drop the cadence way too much. So they go from, say, let's say they're running along with a nice, neat little cadence of 90, and then they start walking at 45 or 40 steps a minute, and then they try and pick that back up to 90, It's much better to come down 65, 70 steps with 1 foot a minute, and then go back up to your 90. And that does not disrupt you mechanically. It doesn't switch off that extensor cross reflex mechanism. That left, right. You think while you're walking, you think rhythm. You don't think rest, you think rhythm. Just come, contain my rhythm, the heart rate will come down, and then all of those benefits, much better temperature control, much better pacing, much, much easier to extend your focus just to your running interval. All I have to run for is the next 6 minutes, or all I have to run for is the next 9 minutes, or all I have to run for is the next 5 minutes.
Yep.
So you're putting together these excellent 5 minute pieces, and the human brain is so much more capable of wrapping its head around, 5 minutes of running, or just wrapping its head around time as opposed to distance, saying, look, I've done 112 on the bike and now I've got to go, do this. And another thing that might help a hell of a lot is people start thinking in the metric system. It's so much easier to think your head around running a kilometer than it is to wrap your head around a mile.
Easier said than done, though. I got to tell you, the first time I ran, I did Ironman Switzerland, and I saw a sign that said 40K left. And I was like, Jesus, how long is that? And I had to start doing the math in my head. And it's like, I'm like, man, I don't know the kilometers. It's like, but it is.
Well, let me tell you a secret. One of the reasons why it took the U.S. such a long time to get back after the 70s Frank Shorter era of marathon running, all right, was because a good runner runs 5 minute pace. But in the rest of the world, a good runner runs 3 minute pace, and 3 minute pace is 4:48 pace.
Okay,
that's why we go to the metric system. we go back to JF Kennedy and we go back to Lyndon B. Johnson and we say, guys, you screwed it up. Let's try again.
I know. Well, that's why when I weigh myself in stones.
No, that's even worse. Oh my goodness! Well, you know that the last physical measure that was kept in France in the museum of whatever was the kilogram, and they had an exact piece of metal that weighed a kilogram, and that was what they kept going back to. This is what a kilogram weighs. And then they found out that the kilogram was losing weight, that iron actually loses weight over time.
I heard about that on public radio. I heard that story. They were trying to recraft or redefine the kilogram.
Exactly. So now it's out the window, and all of them exist, not in physical reality. They calculations.
That's just so funny. It's so
fascinating.
Bobby, I could sit here and talk with you for another 16 or 17 hours, but I'm sure at some point in time you got to eat, do some work, and then probably take a nap and go to bed.
Chris, it was fantastic. I appreciate it very, very much. It was a lot of fun.
Well, thank you, and I look forward to seeing you soon at a race or something, or when I come out to the Springs, we'll rub elbows, and I'll squeeze out some more tips from you, and you can be awesome. And if you ever get a chance, I'll just put it out there to anybody out there listening. Bobby told me the funniest joke this summer that there's no way and I can ever restate it on this broadcast. But if you ever get a chance, ask Bobby the story about, is it Bubba and
Tibidoo.
Tibidoo. Okay, so ask the joke. Just ask the joke, and he'll know what you're talking about. And I'll tell you, you will not regret it. It is the funniest thing you've ever heard in the world. And on that note, Bobby, I will say thank you so much for being on the show. We appreciate you, and we'll look for you. If you want to learn more about Bobby McGee, BobbyMcGeeRunning.com is your website. You've had multiple published books, lots of ways to see videos on YouTube, lots of ways to learn from you, and I truly appreciate you being on our show.
I appreciate that, and also just put out a nod and thank you to USAT. I'm still involved with USAT as a junior under 21 coordinator, development coordinator, so we're still looking for those superstars, so support that, and also just getting back to life again on Instagram at Bobby McGee Running.
All right. Thank you. We thank you for listening today. It's been our pleasure hosting you. And remember, if you want to subscribe, just click on the link below in iTunes. And we look forward to seeing you again sometime. For now, ta-ta, and keep running. See you later, folks. Bye.